From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
We are tired. We are tired of being beaten by policemen. We are tired of seeing our people locked up in jail over and over again. And then you holler, be patient. How long can we be patient? We want our freedom, and we want it now.
A 23-year-old John Lewis speaking at the March on Washington in 1963. Congressman Lewis died on Friday. He was 80 years old. And throughout his life, he never stopped making good trouble, necessary trouble, as he called it, expanding his push for justice and civil rights to the fight for gay marriage, to the need, once again, to protect voting rights, to calling for an end to gun violence, as he did here in 2016.
We were elected to lead, Mr. Speaker. We must be headlights and not taillights. We cannot continue to stick our heads in the sand and ignore the reality of mass gun violence in our nation.
Headlights shining forever forward toward the expansion of the American ideal until, quote, true freedom comes, Lewis said, until the revolution of 1776 is complete. Well, this hour on point, Bernard Lafayette, the Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr. and Representative James Clyburn join us to remember the life and legacy of John Lewis. We will start today with Erin Haynes, though. She is editor-at-large for The 19th, a nonprofit news organization reporting on gender, politics, and policy. And she joins us from Philadelphia. Erin, welcome back to the show.
Meghna, thank you so much. It's good to be with you, although for obviously a very sad occasion.
Of course. I've been thinking about this all weekend. There is a page turning in American history with the death of Congressman Lewis. Just your thoughts on what the nation has now lost since his passing.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I would say with the passing of John Lewis, and also I should say the Reverend C.T. Vivian, who was another civil rights leader, both of them died in Atlanta just hours apart. And, these types of men and women, this generation, what they survived and what they sacrificed in trying to really make this country live up to its founding ideals, right? Until the revolution of 1776 is complete, as Congressman Lewis said, with their passing, for so many years, just their physical presence in many ways was a guardrail. For this country, a reminder not only of an era that I would say most of the country does not want to go back to, but of the progress, that was hard fought and won. And so, without those people here, I think that there is a real fear and concern, especially as we've seen, the retrenchment of racism in our current, political and social climate, even as we see people pushing back against that and trying to reject that in this national reckoning on race that we see. And a lot of that is in the spirit of folks like Congressman Lewis and Reverend Vivian.
Right. There are just the sort of coincidences in history, maybe not coincidences, but facts in history that give me goosebumps sometimes, right? Because you remind us rightly that Reverend C.T. Vivian and Congressman Lewis died within hours of each other. It just suddenly it popped into my mind that, talking about the unfinished work realizing the founding principles of this country, like Thomas Jefferson and John Adams died within hours of each other too. I would put both Reverend Vivian, I would definitely, without a doubt, put both Reverend Vivian and Congressman Lewis in the same firmament as founders of and champions of what should be the American ideal.
That's absolutely right. I mean, those men and women, the folks who were on the front lines, but also, the foot soldiers whose names and faces we don't always know are among our country's founding mothers and fathers, because they really did helped to make our democracy real for so many who had been so long excluded. I mean, I think about that generation, especially the women of that generation too, who had to fight twice as hard to get the vote that we celebrate, obviously, with the centennial of the 19th Amendment, for which my newsroom is named. But really, much like the Greatest Generation, which we honor a lot for defending freedom during World War II, these Black Americans really survived battle, and they helped to perfect our union.
Yeah. Well, Erin, if you can just stand by for a moment, I'd like to now turn to South Carolina Congressman James Clyburn. He joins us from Washington. Congressman Clyburn, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much for having me.
John Lewis was your friend for many decades, both in activism for civil rights and in service in the Congress. Can you tell us what you miss most, you will miss most about him?
Well, thank you so much for that. John and I were friends for six decades. We served here in the Congress together for almost three of those decades. When we met back in October 1960, it was during the time when there was some disenchantment inside the movement. Quite frankly, the night, I think it was October 14th or 15th, is when we sat up with Dr. King from around 10 o'clock in the evening to almost 4 o'clock the next morning. And we were debating what the best tactics were. We came out of that meeting convinced that Martin Luther King Jr.'s tactic of nonviolence was the best for us. That is the weekend that we organized the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. By its name, people knew that we were buying in to King's philosophy. Now, for many of us, we adopted nonviolence as a tactic, but not John Lewis. John Lewis internalized nonviolence. It became his way of life, and he continued right up to the end. Back when the SNCC, as we called it, was taken away from us, it was taken away over tactics. Stokely Carmichael and others felt that there needed to be more activism, more direct action. But they took it to a level that John was not comfortable with. The headlines coming out of that effort were "Burn, Baby, Burn." John was very concerned about that several months ago, and he and I talked about it. The fact that we lost our momentum back in the 1960s over headlines, and we did not want to see the Black Lives Matter movement lose momentum and lose its effectiveness over headlines. So both of us spoke out against defund the police. We thought that was sloganary that could not be helpful. And so John and I spoke Saturday before last now, the Saturday before he passed away. We expressed love for each other, but I knew that was the last time that we would get to talk.
Well, Congressman Clyburn, to have been a fly on the wall on that night that you and Mr. Lewis and Dr. King sat together, I can only imagine how transformative a moment in history that was. But can you tell us a little bit more about the so the fight is not never ends. The United States has made progress, but not enough. Can you tell us a little bit more about how Congressman Lewis sort of saw this moment where we see once again feet marching in the streets of the United States for the continuation of the work of civil rights?
You know, I don't want this to sound too strange, but John went out to Black Lives Matter Plaza with the mayor of Washington. He asked that occur early in the morning, and they stood in that plaza together. On the morning after he passed away, I woke up and I looked out of my window and I saw the sun coming up. And I thought about John and that plaza. And I went outside and set up my tripod and did something I'd never done before. I individually filmed or videoed my tribute to him because I knew that the best thing that we could do for John would be to restore the Voting Rights Act of 1965. That act came about, was signed into law August 6, 1965, after Bloody Sunday in February of 1965. Bloody Sunday on the Edmund Pettus Bridge gave life to the 65 Voting Rights Act. I believe that after the Supreme Court has now gutted that act by getting rid of the formula in Section 4, it really rendered that act useless. So what we need to do now, I think, is to honor John Lewis by following the roadmap that Justice Roberts gave us, telling us what we needed to do in order to make it constitutional again. My staff is now working with other staffs here on the Hill, the staff of Speaker Pelosi, Leader Hoyer, Chairman Bennett Thompson, and Marsha Fudge. We are trying to put on the floor this week the John R. Lewis Voting Rights Act of 2020, because John worked hard for the 7 years since that decision by the Supreme Court in the Shelby v. Holder, trying to restore that act. Let's restore it in John's name, and let's send it over to the Senate. And we ought to pass it, and the president ought to sign it.
Well, South Carolina Congressman James Clyburn, also House Democratic Whip and longtime friend of Congressman John Lewis. Congressman Clyburn, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Aaron Haynes, stand by for just a moment. I also want to note that the House did pass another Voting Rights Restoration Act that is still sitting on Senator Mitch McConnell's desk. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're remembering John Lewis today. The civil rights icon and Georgia congressman died on Friday. He was 80 years old. Back in 2017, Lewis recorded a letter to his younger self. He did that for CBS This Morning. Here he is reading a part of that.
Young John Lewis, you're so full of passion. In your lifetime, you will be arrested 45 times in your mission to help redeem the soul of America.
Well, Erin Haynes joins us today. She's editor at large for The 19th, a nonprofit news organization that reports on gender, politics, and policy. And Erin, before the break, you listened with us to Congressman James Clyburn talking about the House putting forward another Voting Rights Act, which is, you know, it's a terrific idea, and there could be no better way to honor John Lewis's legacy. But as I quickly noted at the end of that segment, they had already done so. They passed one in December of 2019, and it has gone nowhere in the Senate. Senator Mitch McConnell won't put it on the floor for a vote. So there is already the opportunity here to honor John Lewis, and yet for some reason it's just not happening in Congress.
Right, but you know, I really do believe that with the passing of Congressman Lewis, especially for so many of his colleagues in Congress, with voting rights being kind of the signature issue that he was most identified with. I think that issue is going to take on new and even stronger meaning for folks who are trying to make that legislation real. And, you know, I think that that is a way that they see. I mean, you see within, you know, not even 72 hours of John Lewis's passing, that this strategy is already in motion as a way that they feel would be the most appropriate way to honor Congressman Lewis's legacy. And you know, I think voting rights and the issue of voter suppression was something that was already on the ballot for a lot of voters, particularly Black voters, mm-hmm. right? But I think that that the congressman's passing is really something that could go a long way to galvanizing not only Black voters, but I also think Black lawmakers and really anyone who is concerned with the issue of voting rights and ballot access, which, you know, used to be a bipartisan issue, but has become pretty polarizing and politicized in recent years. And so really to make it about John Lewis, somebody who, you know, was beloved on both sides of the aisle by so many, I think really reframes and potentially resets this conversation for some folks. And it'll mm-hmm. be interesting to see if Congress is able to make some headway on this legislation in a way that they were not when the congressman was still with us.
Right. You know, but although if just to sort of lay bare some of my personal cynicism here, what does it say about America that it takes John Lewis and other activists in 1965 having their heads cracked, bashed in by police while trying to cross the Pettus Bridge to galvanize the signing of the first Voting Rights Act in 1965. And then decades later, it takes the same man's passing to possibly regalvanize the movement to restore that very act, right? I mean,
And also Congressman Clyburn, right, who was on the yes. front lines as a young man in South Carolina fighting for voting rights, fighting for civil rights, and is now still on the front lines. And he is almost 80 years old, right, still pushing for a lot of the same things that he was fighting for as a young man. But I think, you know, I think what we know about America is that racial progress and backlash have always been the push and pull of this democracy. And that, you know, people of Congressman Clyburn and Congressman Lewis's generation were declaring in their time that Black Lives Matter, and they were fighting to make the country recognize this as a statement of fact. And you know, as I believe you were saying earlier, this is something that does have to be defended over and over again in this democracy. And it's. You know, things like voting rights are, you know, they are fragile. And, you know, folks who are committed to making the country live up to its founding ideals must be vigilant about that in every yes. generation.
Yeah. Well, Erin, hang on here for just a moment, because I'd like to now turn to the Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr. He's founder of the Rainbow Coalition, a former presidential candidate, and of course, longtime civil rights activist and icon as well. He worked alongside Congressman Lewis for decades and was also, as people should remember, he was with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis on the day Dr. King was assassinated. So, Reverend Jackson, welcome to the program.
Good to hear your voice, Magna.
So, Reverend Jackson, first of all, tell us, what is it that you will miss most in your friend John Lewis?
We've been together since 1960 when both were Senate leaders. At that time, I've known John for 6 years. I miss being able to call him on the phone, get a call from him. I think one of the mistakes that's been made in the analysis lab is that John joined the movement after 58 years of legal apartheid in America, separate but equal decision of President versus Ferguson. Thurgood Marshall led the drive across Baker Modern and to make apartheid illegal, 1954. Must hook up May 1754 with August 6, 65. Let me put it this way. I asked Mrs. Parks one day, why did you sit in? She said, well, we're testing the 54 decisions to see if they were valid. And she said, I thought about going to the back of the bus, but in the jail, I couldn't go back to Moses, period, there. And so he joined Dr. King, who joined Rosa Parks, about protecting the law. It took us 8 years to get from public accommodations up in the back of the bus, the 64. John took it to a greater conclusion. The other thing is that the 65 Voting Rights Act was democracy, was born in Selma, Alabama, not in Philadelphia. Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, because of our ideals. Only white male landowners could vote. White male landowners could vote. And it exploded back in that. White women couldn't vote. Blacks couldn't vote. And so, out of Selma, blacks could vote for the first time in 85 years. White women could serve on juries. 18 years to vote for the first time, they could vote on campuses. Native American people could vote bilingually. So in many ways, represents democracy, Selma, Alabama, not Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
So, Reverend Jackson, I think your phone line's a little shaky here, so I just want to recap a tiny bit. If people couldn't hear all of it, you talked about Plessy versus Ferguson, and you essentially just gave us a history of the work and fight to expand that American ideal that you were talking about.
The frame of May 1754, August 6, 1964, is the frame. John wrote Dr. King, and he's the boy from Troy. Dr. King had joined the movement led by Thurgood Marshall, the legal foundation. The huge decision to make. We were legally inferior to 54. The state's rights barbarism abounded, and there was no further protection from denying the right to vote. Back of the buses and Dr. King spoke in Washington, and John Lewis spoke from Florida to Maryland. We couldn't use a single public toilet. Black and brown soldiers sit behind lots of prison wall on American road trip bases. We couldn't use Holiday Inn or Howard Johnson. That was a struggle. John was a part of a struggle that had mature meaning. Those who fight today must look into a struggle that has lasting value.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to your point, Mr. Lewis was like you said, he was 17 when he first wrote to Dr. King, because he wanted to go to what's now called Troy University. So I take your point very, very well, Reverend Jackson. But what would you describe then? How do you view then what we should see as Congressman Lewis's role in that bigger historical movement that you're talking about?
He joined the SLC in 1960. The sit-in took place in Greensboro, North Carolina, February 1st. Students formed SNCC at Shaw University in the spring of that year. I hooked up with John in the fall of that year, 1960. And SNCC was connected to the other civil rights organizations. They were not focused on generation, but intergenerational. They joined the movement that was already in progress. Like Madeline Tumble joined ANC, they didn't just start something. They joined the movement to a greater conclusion. The youth vitality students marching around the country. And so John, with his courage and with his willingness to suffer, he raised the valedictorian of our class. Many of us sat in. I was a judge in 1960 myself. But John is the valedictorian of our class.
He
suffered the most, endured the most. John was a long-distance runner.
A long-distance runner. Do you have a favorite memory of Congressman Lewis that you think sort of really epitomizes the kind of man he was?
Well, sitting around talking with C.T. Vivian. C.T. Vivian, you know, who died the same day. C.T., from Missouri to McComb. C.T. sat in 1947 in McComb, Illinois, 8 years before Montgomery, 14 years before the sit-ins. we started talking with guys who had been in that circle for a long time. That's, I remember sitting around just talking about the history of our circle. And we live in, I think we live under the law. And so we were rooted in it. That's why I urge those Black Lives Matter to be rooted in their ongoing struggle. So right now, we got the right to go in 65. But then in 2013, the Robert Square decapitated it, took away its sting, and the federal protections. It must be protected. We must fight for the constitutional right to vote. My brother, if the Black Lives Matter movement gets to the constitutional right to vote, it'll be an indelible imprint in time. The constitutional, right now we have 50 separate state elections. We'll have a national on the election day. We have 50 elections. You see, it has its own apparatus. One for Washington, one for, Mississippi, one for Seattle, one for Miami. We've got a national election with guidelines that turn the right to vote. I hope that this movement today was not just on police, but on voting power, because police patrol us, or they control us. Politicians determine behavior of police. Police don't determine behavior of politicians. So politicians, patrolmen, like for example, in Minnesota where George Floyd was killed, I went and met with the governor and met with the prosecutor from the county. See, he said he could do nothing about the guy who killed George Floyd. Well, we were able to get Keith Ellison, the state attorney general, who a majority of the white state, he's the state attorney general. He immediately arrested the four and charged them. First time a white officer been in jail ever for killing a black in Minnesota. Politics determined police behavior. When the young man was killed in Atlanta, Georgia, Paul Howard was elected. Paul Howard charged him with murder. So John Saul said, the focus on police to me is like the epidermis. But politics is the bone marrow of this thing. Those who legislate and make priorities.
Uh-huh. Interesting. So just to underscore what you said defunding the police is like the epidermis, but politics is the marrow, right, of how you make change in the United States. I've just got a minute or two left with you, Reverend Jackson. I just want to ask you one more question. On Saturday, you put out a statement about Congressman Lewis. You said he is what patriotism and courage look like. Can you just tell us a little bit more about the character of this man that you knew so well?
Well, to be willing to grab the freedom, the buses. When I grew up in Rainbow, South Carolina, all the bus drivers were local, were white. All the Greyhound and Greyhound buses and Trevor buses were white. And you had to sit in the colored section. The Freedom Rides, which CT was a part of, by the way, was a dangerous mission. They set the bus on finance in Alabama. John was on those buses in Rock Hill, South Carolina, and Alabama. It was a real risky curve. Matter of fact, they came to Atlanta. They came discouraged them from taking it further south. Danger. John took the danger in half. He was on a burning bus. We were on a burning bridge. I once asked George Wallace. George Wallace said we had prayer before he died. Met with him. George, he had more blacks in his cabinet at that time than the Southern governor. So we talked. I said, why did you turn the dogs loose on all the marches? He just said, I did my favor. I said, favor? He said, if I had not let the troopers beat them, the mob would have been worse. It never occurred to him to disperse the mob, but beat the marches. It's the kind of backwards and federal thinking we had to deal with. So that Sunday, we didn't anticipate the confrontation. The King's in his church in Atlanta, Georgia. Abner's in his church in Atlanta, Georgia. Henry's in his church in Atlanta, Georgia. The King heard, got a note in the pulpit that the march had just been beaten. He left the church and went to Selma. John Lewis and Jose were Miss Amiga Boynton. Don't leave her out. Miss Boynton, she is the woman who
at the Dallas County Boys League. She invited Dr. King to Selma in December of that year. Dr. King was there at the guest of the Dallas County Boys League. I'm saying because there are some pieces here. John was not a show horse, he was a workhorse. John was not a hero, not a champion. When champions win, they ride the people's shoulders. Heroes win, people ride their shoulders. Who rode John's shoulders on the bus? Who rode John's shoulders in the voting rights act? John was a gift that kept on giving. I remember him a couple of weeks ago, and John, at that time, agreed to be the voting rights, along with Andy Young, the co-chair of the voting rights for the fall. He was the gift that never stopped giving.
Well, Reverend Jesse Jackson, Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr., I thank you so very much for joining us today to help remember Congressman John Lewis. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Aaron Haynes, stand by for just a moment. We'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
Smart journalism, fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the life of Congressman John Lewis. He died on Friday at the age of 80. And just before the break, we were speaking with the Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr. Now, it's live radio, so I just want to acknowledge that his phone line was pretty rough, and it might have been difficult to understand what he was saying. I kept going with that conversation because it's just too important right now. So my staff doesn't even know I'm about to do this, but I'm about to ask them. We'll do the very best that we can to go back and listen to that conversation with the Reverend Jackson and get a transcription of it up on our website as soon as we can, because he actually had a lot of very important things to say in memories of Congressman Lewis, which are worth at least us being able to read, hopefully, by this evening. So sorry, staff, but that's what you have to do in moments of history. And I appreciate the work that we're going to do to scramble to make that happen. Now, listen, one thing that we definitely were able to hear is that the Reverend Jesse Jackson and Aaron Haynes, who also joins us this hour, both mentioned that also on Friday, the Reverend C.T. Vivian died. He was a trusted advisor to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., a famed civil rights leader himself, the Reverend Vivian was. So here he is in the early 1960s, confronting a Dallas County sheriff who was preventing black people from registering to vote.
But believe me, there were those that followed Hitler, like you blindly follow this Sheriff Clark, who didn't think their day would come. But they also were pulled into the courtrooms, and they were also given their death sentences. You are not this bad a racist, but you're racist in the same way that Hitler was a racist. And you're blindly following a man that's leading you down a road that's going to bring you into federal court. Now, I am representing people in Dallas County, and I have that right to do so. Now, and as I represent them, and they can speak for themselves, is what I'm saying true?
Yes.
Is it what you think and what you believe?
Yes.
Boy, this is not a local problem, gentlemen. This is a national problem. You can't keep anyone in the United States from voting without hurting the rights of all other citizens. Democracy's built on this. This is why every man has the right to vote, regardless.
That's the Reverend C.T. Vivian in the early 1960s. He also died on Friday, the same day as Congressman John Lewis. Now, Aaron, you wrote a piece for the Washington Post this weekend about Reverend Vivian. There might be some listeners out there who are less familiar with him than Congressman Lewis. Can you just tell us a little bit more about Reverend Vivian?
Absolutely. And thank you, Meghna, for bringing that up, because Cordy Tyndale Vivian and Congressman Lewis, their destinies were intertwined all the way up until their deaths. C.T. Vivian was part of the Nashville student movement sit-ins, just like Congressman Lewis. That clip that you just played, with C.T. Vivian confronting Sheriff Clark, that was a month before Bloody Sunday. C.T. Vivian also fought for voting rights in Selma and stared down white supremacy and violence. He was punched in the face by Sheriff Clark for daring to challenge, what was happening down in Selma and demanding that Black voters there be registered to vote. C.T. Vivian was also awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by Barack Obama because of his lifelong commitment to civil and human rights and responsibility. And, you know, it's important to lift him up, even as we are lifting up Congressman Lewis, because we really cannot honor Congressman Lewis without honoring C.T. Vivian. And I think that it is fitting that they passed on the same day in the same city, because C.T. Vivian has a legacy that really was just as large. But you know, Meghna, if I can just take a second to add, listening to Reverend Jackson, I started my career interviewing a lot of these people: Reverend Vivian, Ambassador Young, Congressman Lewis, Reverend Jackson, and others. Mm. I was interviewing them about the legacy of the work that they did. Right. And I now find myself covering the threat to that progress that they fought for. And these are men and women who, at their age now have lived long enough to see both the gains and the losses of their efforts. And yet, these really are heroes. I mean, these people who were always willing to fight until they took their last breath for what they believed in, right? I mean, for Dr. King, obviously that was age 39, but you still see, I mean, you just heard Reverend Jackson's key, Congressman Lewis, Ambassador Young were committed to a push for voting rights even this fall, right?
Right.
They're still on the front lines. Congressman Clyburn is nearly 80 years old, still on the front lines. I mean, that just is really, really so remarkable.
Hmm. Well, if you can just hang on for another few minutes, Aaron, I now want to turn to Bernard Lafayette.
He's absolutely
a civil rights activist. Yeah, and was obviously a student activist in many campaigns in the 1960s, staff member at the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, program director at Martin Luther King Jr.'s Southern Christian Leadership Conference. He was a dormitory mate with John Lewis, and also author of several books, including In Peace and Freedom, My Journey in Selma. Bernard Lafayette, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, Mr. Lafayette, I just wonder if you could just tell us a quick story about when you first met John Lewis. I believe it was at college in Nashville, and you shared that room with him. What kind of things did you talk about? What was that like, sharing that space with him?
Well, one of the things that we always talked about was the racial situation and the segregation and the impact on the minds of the people, because what we many times think about is what happens to Black people because of the segregation and discrimination. But we don't think about what happens to the white people, particularly the young people coming up. And I think that was one of the most important things that happened, is that we recognized that we needed to have white young people involved in the movement. And we made sure that happened. We made special efforts.
Hmm. Well, I think I believe I read that you had previously said that it was John Lewis who got you to come to the seminars on nonviolent protest that Reverend Lawson was having at the time. Is that right? Bernard Lafayette, are you still there? We're going to try and get him back on the line here. Aaron Haynes, react to what Mr. Lafayette just said there about the belief early on in the importance of sort of showing white Americans the effect that segregation was having on them.
Absolutely. And also the importance of that multiracial coalition, right? Which I think that we're seeing today in this national moment of reckoning. And many of the folks that are on the front lines today took the lessons of folks, young folks like Bernard Lafayette, like Congressman Lewis, like C.T. Vivian. These folks started Diane Nash, right? That these folks started so young, they left a blueprint behind for the young people that we see confronting racism today. And you think about the white folks who joined with so many of them for Freedom Summer, right? Who went down into the Deep South and tried to confront systemic racism together. It does take white Americans of conscience to also be part of this movement. And really, that helps to turn the tide and tip the scale, really, to get the kind of racial progress that Black folks have been raising the alarm about systemic racism for the entirety of the time that we have been in this country, right? But it really takes a multiracial coalition to get on board, to really confront the that systemic racism in the big structural way that it must be confronted for things to be different for those communities, right?
Yeah. Well, absolutely. And hopefully I think we have Mr. Lafayette back on the line. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Apologies about the technical difficulties. Yes, I can. And I apologize for the technical difficulties we've been having today, Mr. Lafayette. But I wonder if I could ask you a question about the day or the moment in the civil rights movement in the 60s that Congressman Lewis himself said that he thought it was his most important moment then. And that's, of course, the march from Selma to Montgomery for voting rights. And that day when he was on the Edmund Pettus Bridge with other activists and they were literally beaten back by police, I wonder if you could just tell us about your experience of that day.
I was very much involved in the Selma March, okay?
Yes.
But by this time I was in Chicago, okay? But I had started much earlier in Selma, Alabama. But what is a very little known fact is that when you see one of the photos of the group going into Montgomery, Alabama, you see a black fella with a tam on backwards, and he's holding the American flag. And Martin Luther King and Mrs. King and Abernathy, all those are behind him. You see that picture in the museum. That picture of the in the museum doesn't say his name, but that fellow name is Lamar McCoy. Lamar McCoy was the head of the Vice Lords gang in the west side of Chicago. I trained those gang members in Chicago to be marshals on the Selma March. This was all very quiet, because I wanted the gang members in Chicago to have a nonviolent experience, and I wanted them to have a very specific role. So when we started the movement in Chicago, they would have a role to play, and they were marshals. And so therefore, they would not go out and do gang stuff. So this was like boot camp for the Chicago gang.
And so tell me more in the last minute that we have, Mr. Lafayette, if you could, What was it about John Lewis, in his heart and his soul and his character, that allowed him to work so tirelessly for so many decades, all the way until the end of his life, to continue to try to realize the dream?
John Lewis was committed as a child when he experienced segregation in rural Alabama, and he realized that that's the kind of life that you would have to live, and he rejected that. And that's why he took to Martin Luther King, because of the Martin Luther King's movement there in Montgomery, Alabama, which was very not too far from Troy. We could listen to Martin Luther King on the radio. So we heard his speeches and that kind of thing. And he was a minister, and John Lewis was interested in the ministry. So he began to look at what kind of ministry he was going to have in his life. That's why John didn't get involved in pastoring church or nothing like that, because he felt that this was the most important thing that he could contribute. I was his roommate at the American Baptist College, and he's the one that persuaded me to go to the nonviolent classes that Jim Lawson was taking, the workshop. And he wanted to make a difference in these things, and he saw a way to do it, and that was through the nonviolent approach and the confrontation. So I was with him in Nashville, and I was with him, you know, in many movements along the way, the Freedom Rides. He and I desegregated the buses before 1961, and the Freedom Rides
started. That's right, in Nashville, indeed. Well, you know what? I hear that phone line getting shaky again, so I'm afraid I'm just going to have to wrap up with that. Bernard Lafayette, civil rights leader who was John Lewis's college roommate in the 1960s, as you just heard, desegregated the Greyhound lines in Nashville, author of many books on civil rights, including In Peace and Freedom, My Journey in Selma. Mr. Lafayette, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Aaron Haynes, editor-at-large for The 19th, thank you so much for joining us today to remember Congressman Lewis.
Thank you, Magna.
And folks, we want to wrap up this hour by hearing the congressman himself again, and we want to turn back to the final words from Lewis's speech at the March on Washington in 1963. Remember, he was 23 years old then. It put him on the national stage, a place he never left, and at the heart of the question of what kind of nation this country truly wishes to be. So let's listen. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
But we will march with the spirit of love and with the spirit of dignity that we have shown here today. By the forces of our demand, our determination, and our numbers, we shall splinter the segregated South into a thousand pieces and put them together in the image of God and democracy. We must say, wake up, America, wake up, for we cannot stop, and we will not and cannot be patient.